This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl, and getting your science questions has gotten so much easier. Usually you can text them in live on the day, but we are asking you for your questions right now. If you scroll to the show notes, there is a link for you there, and you can submit your question whenever you want. We might follow up with a sneaky phone call, but either way, we want to get you and your question on the air. To not have to rely on the text line, go chuck in your question right now. Let's see what we get, what we can collect from the podcast family. Thank you so much for listening. This is Science with Dr. Carl, and on this week's episode, we get an update on the Artemis II, how it went, what Dr. Carl thinks the future of this mission is going to be. We get into a lot about space, including the one planet that Dr. Carl would travel to. He ends up giving about 7 answers, but all of them, excellent. Let's get into it. Carl, how you doing?
Ever so peachy keen.
Now talk to us. Artemis 2, where are we at? How'd it go?
I'm so happy that it came back. It was just an amazing thing, and the outpouring of emotion and the fact that several hundred thousand bits and pieces of hardware came together with the brain power of a whole lot of humans, and we did that amazing thing of leaving the bonds of Earth's gravity, being at some stage more influenced by the moon's gravity, and then coming back alive. And now there's a whole bunch of plans for the future, and it may be politically driven, it may not be. What I really am interested in is the follow-up of the heat shield. The heat shield was a critical thing. On one side, you got 10,000 degrees C. On the other side, you got humans, and in between, you've got aluminium, which gets really soft or melts at a couple of hundred degrees. Mm-hmm. What's supposed to happen is an ablative thing, a fancy word, ablative, which means that literally, as it comes through the atmosphere, individual atoms and molecules get ripped off, one layer, the next, and it should all happen evenly, but the material is not flexible, it's stiff, and suddenly you might have a chunk, and if that chunk is 10 centimeters thick, then suddenly the 10,000 degree air is kissing the 200 degree aluminium.
Wow.
There were hints that a bit of that was getting close on Artemis 1. They redesigned trajectories. I'd like to see the engineering follow-up on Artemis 2 and how under their new re-entry path, the heat shield survived. But it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. I'm so happy that everybody was happy.
Ed in Blaxland, you've got a question about Artemis 2. What do you want to know?
Hey, doctors. Yeah, look, I'm just curious. Lots of maths that I don't really understand, but up in the atmosphere there's thousands of satellites, some size of toasters and some we don't even know about, I assume, from Russia and China. Mm-hmm. How do they miss all those on the way back in and on the way out?
Okay, Ed, I'm going to hit you with a question without notice. So you're on the air. You have to answer questions, Dr. Ed. You ready for it? I'll give you a bit of background. Okay, right. So 2017, maybe 3,000 working satellites. 2026, 15,000. And then 2030, 4 years from now, 50,000. Okay, so we've got about 12,000-13,000 of these Starlink satellites. Here's a question for you without notice. They want to avoid running into each other. And so they all know where each other are, and there's some sort of artificial intelligence in there. How often, here's a question, how often do you think one of those Starlink satellites has to fire its rockets to avoid running into another one? There you are. Pick a number in time. Like, is it seconds, minutes, hours, centuries, whatever? Pick a number.
Oh, I was hoping it would be days at least, but anyway.
2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. Gosh darn.
Yeah, gosh darn. Yes.
Gosh darn. And that's the way it is now. Right?
Imagine what it's going to be in 2034 or whatever you said. It's going to be crazy.
By 2030... It is kind of crazy. There's a thing called the Kessler syndrome, which was built into the movie Gravity with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, where one collision in space sets off a dozen particles, which then run into a whole bunch of other particles, chain reaction. Low Earth orbit becomes unusable. So how did they avoid them on their way in? Space is big, and they did the best they could with the mathematics that they have. And luckily, we've got high-speed computers, so that was part of it. The chances are very small, but on the other hand, every 2 minutes, a Starlink has to fire its Krypton rocket. So what they have is a gas called Krypton, and they get electricity from their solar panels. the size of these starlings, like a flatbed truck, 9 meters by 2 meters by maybe 30 centimeters thick, lots of solar panels, and then they electrically charge the krypton atoms. They go one way, the satellite goes the other way. How'd they miss them on the way in? A lot of planning and thinking and good luck. A tiny amount of good luck.
Yeah, but we don't know where the Russians and Chinese satellites are, I assume.
Oh, they can't hide them. They can pick them. There used to be a place called NORAD, look it up in Wikipedia, which is a mountain in Colorado that they hollowed out, and they kept an eye on all this stuff, and now they're keeping more of an eye on it.
We got Steph in Colorado here. Dr. Steph, what's your question about the moon?
I was just wondering, I'd heard that we were getting interested in the moon again, not just for yay moon, but because of the resources that people wanted on the moon. So I wanted to ask if that's true, like what resources and like what could be the repercussions of like mining on the moon?
Sure. Okay, so what resources and the repercussions? Can you just say yay moon with a bit more enthusiasm this time? It's so funny.
Yay moon.
Oh, come on. Pretend that you're doing PR for the space agency. Come on, lay it on us. Come on. Yay moon. Yeah, okay. So on one hand, they're saying that we need something called helium-3, which could be a nuclear power source. Further down the line, they made it up. Okay, really? Water, ice, and hydrogen. And you're thinking, water? Wouldn't it just, when it's ice, evaporate? But there are some parts of the moon that are cold. There are some parts of the moon that literally never see sunlight. So we're talking about a crater near a pole. And so that way it can always be in sunlight. And they want to mine that to give them the minerals. Of course, they can recycle the water, but there's always going to be losses. So what they want is a fair bit of water that they can go for. And then whatever else they can find. So they can extract the surface, they call it regolith, to get oxygen and metals and maybe construction materials. So you get some of this soft dust and you glue it together. The soft dust was incredibly corrosive and would get everywhere. There'll be a whole lot of problems they're going to run into. These are called engineering problems. The helium-3, the clean fusion, they go on about it, but really we're a long way away from that. And basically construction materials and oxygen is what they're really after. And the fact that you have lots of sunlight is good. The trouble is, a day instead of being 12 hours is 14 days. So, mate, you got sunlight like crazy and then suddenly you've got 14 days of your batteries having to keep you going. But we are getting so much better with our battery technology. Is that kind of answering your question a little bit? You got a follow-up question there?
That's really interesting. But, yeah, I was also just wondering what would be the repercussions if we...
Oh, we humans are so messy. So there's, on the ocean floor, around the world in many parts, there are these rich nodules of metal like manganese and magnesium and all sorts of stuff. They're something between the size of a ping pong ball and your fist. And they're way down. We're talking kilometres down. And they're saying, let's just go down there and vacuum the little buggers up. And on one hand, yes, they are concentrated sources of metals, but what damage will we create to the oceans and all the problems we've done before? Don't we see that we don't just take everything and not care about the future? I mean, we've got to care about the future of you and your nieces and nephews and everybody else. So I think we could create harm and we have to do it in a nice way. And we can do it in a nice way, but that involves thinking for the future.
Thanks, yeah. Steph.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Total change of pace now. Anna in Alice Springs, you read about a bit of a link between two things. What's going on?
Yes, I was a little bit concerned. And the other night I was scrolling on TikTok and I saw a TikTok about the potential link between chronic nose picking and Alzheimer's disease. So as a chronic nose picker myself, I was wondering whether there is any, truth behind it.
Anna, I saw this too.
And what did they say? That there was a medical link or did they just say that there's none? Did they quote a scientific paper?
Well, they were talking about the fact that obviously like your sense of smell is something that goes first when you get Alzheimer's disease, and that like obviously the olfactory nerve sits inside your nose and that's, very close to your brain. So potentially kind of bringing in all of the bacteria from your finger into your nose could, I don't know, hopefully not, but kind of bring on Alzheimer's earlier.
Okay, the technical term for this, where you really want to pick your nose, is called rhinotilexomania. Rhino for nose, exo out, mania, you can't help yourself. And most people do it to remove what's technically called nasal debris. But a surprisingly large number of people do it for convenience. And a small number of people, of the order of a percent or less, do it for, and I quote, sexual pleasure, unquote.
Okay.
Yes, you do have erectile tissue in your nose, and we'll just stop right there because who knows who's listening. Now, the main link is not so much that the sense of smell, because it is well known that as a part of Alzheimer's, you will lose your sense of smell. But picking your nose will not make you lose your sense of smell. But I think the greater link is that you might change the bacterial makeup of your nose, which could then flow down into the bacterial makeup of your of what's in your gut. The bacteria in your gut are incredibly important to your physical health and, it turns out, mental health. And just the other day I was reading in New Scientist, possibly Alzheimer's. So you could possibly recolonize nasty bacteria that don't normally exist in your body from because you touched something and it went into your nose and then you went and then it went down into your gut and then they could possibly recolonize. So that's what they're worried about. At this stage, I would happily go about nose picking. Oh, I'm not allowed to give medical advice. Forget what I just said. But it's so convenient when you've got this big lump in your way and what do? Just sort of leave it there until you go and see an ear, nose and throat surgeon every year.
Yeah, you got to dance with the tissue. Like it's just...
Dance with the tissue. Oh, tissue. Oh, really?
Yeah. So
wealthy, are we? You got tissues. Yeah. Oh, right.
Got to get a tissue up there and just...
Some of us just do it without the tissue, but we won't even go about that. So at this stage, I'd say watch this space. The link is weak. What was the person? Was they like a science communicator or a neurobiologist?
I don't know if they had any qualifications, but they were positing themselves as some sort of scientist, I would say.
Well, there is an old Polish saying, the sky is still blue even if the devil says so. And even if they've got no qualifications, they could accidentally be saying something true or vice versa. Don't know. I would tend to... Okay. Personally, if I were the sort of person who picked my nose, which I may or may not be, I would keep on doing it, even if I don't do it or do it. There you are.
Okay.
And that's not medical advice for anybody to follow.
Okay. Does that help, Anna?
Does that help,
Anna?
Yes,
perfect. Don't
need a bit of
you know what I'm talking about. Wink, wink. Okay, right. Gotcha, mate.
Stu in Redcliffe, what do you want to know?
Morning, doctors. I'm just wondering, if I'm running at 20 k's an hour, how fast are my feet going? Because my back foot has got to overtake my body to get in front of the other foot.
Right.
What the numbers are.
Right. So you're running 20 kilometres an hour. And so if we pick your centre of gravity as being roughly near your belly button, it's kind of going forward at 20 kilometres an hour. You know, it's jumping between 18 and 22, but we'll call it 20. But when your foot is on the ground, it's not sliding. So you got everything else is in the air, but you got one foot on the ground. It's not sliding. So relative to the ground, it's got zero velocity. And then you have to accelerate it up to equal the velocity of your body. And then you have to take it ahead of your body. So maybe it's got to go up to 25. But that's just a little bit on the end of your body. So this is a very incisive way of, or a clear way of thinking about moving bodies and relative motion. Is that kind of answering your question?
Yeah, I'm wondering, it doesn't really matter what the speed is. Is there a formula that, like the runners do, like the Olympians and that sort of stuff, would they have some sort of formula to say if you want to be at this speed, then that's how fast your feet are going?
Not really. They will do, we're talking the top athletes, they will do biomechanics. And if you want to know the god of biomechanics, it's R... the letter R for Robert, McNeil, that's a middle name, Alexander. So chase them up and they've done this sort of stuff. And there will be part of that as their training. Now, part of the training, though, the majority of their training is the physical part, but there's also the mental part. We have this weird situation where on one hand, your body is at its physical peak, 18 to 25. And yet in some sports, people keep on getting better into their 20s and 30s and even 40s. And there's an interesting article, again in New Scientist, blah, 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 about how your brain is really important in this. And part of the training of people is sometimes to trick them. So you're trying to do what they call the four-minute mile. A mile is an ancient measure used only in the United States and somewhere else. And people would do these four laps, a quarter of a mile each, and occasionally they just could not break the four-minute mile, and they would trick them. They'd have clocks up, and the clocks would have the wrong time, and they'd think, oh, I've just got to go a bit faster, and they would go faster, and they would actually break the four-minute mile because they got tricked into it. And so the mental training is an incredibly important part. But so doing the biomechanics, they'd touch on it, but it wouldn't be a major part of their training in most cases.
Mm-hmm. Does that okay, thank you very help? Much. Yes, thank you. Yes.
Thank you,
Stu. Thank you, Dr. Stu.
Chris in Geelong, you got a question about memory.
Yeah, morning, doctors. Problem about memory is every now and then I would just be working away in the workshop and then a completely random memory will come into my head, like a coffee shop I used to walk past on the way to the supermarket in Toronto. It has nothing to do with what I'm doing, but I've always wondered, is it a way of your brain going, hey, do you remember this? Do you want to keep it or should I get rid of it? Is it like decluttering your brain or something?
Yeah.
Okay, so first part of the answer, because we're all terribly woke and care about each other, is this distressing to you? Does it bother you?
No.
Okay, right. You just had to get that out of the way. Right, okay. Yeah. Now,
Dr. Carl doing a welfare check. Yeah.
Is that the technical term for it?
Yeah, just checking in.
Okay, right. And second question, what sort of workshop you do? I love mechanical stuff.
So I make lighting, so woodwork, essentially.
Oh, woodwork is so satisfying. Okay, we'll talk about that later. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of things going on. There's spontaneous recall. Your brain is continually reorganizing and reactivating the memories. And sometimes it'll go through and then suddenly think, coffee shop in Toronto, and it just happened to pop up. And this is just normal and everyday. Secondly, there can be a cue from the outside world. I've been awake for a whole 2 hours. Oh, my God, I've got to have a coffee. Coffee shop in Toronto just pops up and is sort of accidentally cued. And you didn't even know that you were sort of thinking, I need to have my little break at the 2 hour mark. And then the brain does a lot of testing of memory subconsciously in the background and it reactivates and then puts them away again. And that could be them just doing the brain doing its own internal retrieval practice. Okay, a little detour here. Part of dreaming is your brain will reorganize the memories. And so if you're in a situation where you get together with a bunch of mates every day to have morning tea, which for some reason is no longer part of business in general because that whole 10 minutes was sort of, wow, that cuts into productivity. But I think it's really important because you learn a lot of stuff. And so if you have a group of people who get together, it's worthwhile going through your memories of the previous day. And every now and then somebody will say, hang on, if you've got enough confidence in yourself, I have no memory of what you just said, even though we're all together. And most people are ashamed to say that because they think, oh, my God, I'm senile. But no, what happened is that your brain threw that memory away. And if you're in a group of people and you do it every day, gradually it'll cycle through that each of you has lost something from the previous day.
Why does your brain throw it away? Just to free up a bit of room or?
Kind of, but also accessing it, the amount of memories you can have. Like on one occasion, my wife said, here's our crossword clue, Burmese freedom fighters of World War II. And I said, I read it in the Reader's Digest 20 years ago. And then I forgot about it, let my brain work on it. And then about 5 minutes later, my lungs contracted and out came the word chindit, C-H-I-N-D-I-T, which I had never said in my entire life. So if you treat your brain carefully and acknowledge what your strengths and weaknesses are, you can improve your memory and finally you can do memory courses. Also, I forgot to mention, there could be an emotional thing happening in your brain that triggers these memories. But I imagine if you're in woodworking, you're just into the wood, man.
And maybe Mr. Toronto, Chris.
Maybe, ooh. Yeah.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your question. Nick in Adelaide, I love this hypothetical. What do you want to know?
Morning, doctors. I'm just wondering, if you go to a bakery or a service station or something and buy a cold drink and a warm pie or sausage roll, if you put them next to each other on the seat, which one would change temperature quicker? Would the cold drink get warmer quicker or would the hot pie or sausage roll get cooler quicker?
Okay, just a little background question. Where there's no external source of heat or coolth. They're just sort of sitting on an insulated surface effectively.
Yeah, just sitting on, say, the front seat of the car.
Okay, there's two concepts that you need to deal with to be able to solve this problem. Yeah. The first one is thermal capacity. So plastic can't store a lot of heat, whereas metal can store quite a bit of heat. So plastic that's 5 degrees hotter than the environment will store that heat for a lot longer, heat is energy, than will plastic. And your typical case would be, I guess, picking the things out of the dishwasher where the plastic doesn't store enough heat to be able to evaporate with its stored heat the water. So thermal capacity. And by the way, have you ever done a thing of picking up a cast iron fry pan after 10 minutes on the stove and you go, oh my God, that's hot?
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Water has 5 times the thermal capacity of cast iron. So cast iron is high, but water is 5 times higher. And still, no matter how old you are, you go, oh my God, I just stupidly burnt my mouth again with a hot soup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not you, it's the thermal capacity. So that's your first capacity, your first thing, yep. Thermal capacity. And so water has a very high thermal capacity. The glass of the container, moderate. The plastic, if it was plastic, low again. And then with the sausage roll, the pastry has a very low thermal capacity, but inside, the meatoid concentrated mixture does have a high one. So thermal capacity is one aspect. The second aspect is thermal transfer or insulation. So you can walk around on a carpet at 10 degrees C, and because it's such a good insulator, you don't notice how cold it is until you go into the bathroom where the tiles are at exactly the same temperature of the carpet, but they've got much better heat transferability. And so the transferability of the insulation ability of the sausage roll pastry is a good insulator. The meat inside, it transfers heat like crazy. It's not a good insulator. And the glass of the bottle is a pretty good transfer of heat. It's pretty good transferring heat, and so is the water. So you have to juggle all of those together. Now, you could go to some of those stores. You can buy these heat measuring things that are not a thermometer, but just a laser pointer. I bought one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, they're amazing. So you could actually do the experiment at home. And if you do, you could win a fun pack from Triple J. ..
Well, there you go. I've got one at my home, actually, for my pizza oven.
Oh, Nick, I'm wanting a strawberry milk and a sausage roll.
Yeah. Strawberry? No, not chocolate?
Nah, I go with strawberry.
What about you, Nick? Are you chocolate or strawberry?
Or banana or caramel?
Oh, I'd probably go chocolate. Oh, no, not banana.
Mm.
I tend to follow the advice of...
Yeah,
I follow Richard Feynman, that Nobel Prize winner, who, when asked what he chose for dessert, said, I always go for chocolate because while it's not necessarily the best, it's never the worst.
Yep, that's it. You can't go wrong.
High standard there with chocolate.
Simon in Gladstone Park, we were talking earlier about, you know, we're seeing maybe some more attention online about the connection between nose picking and Alzheimer's. And Dr. Carl brought us a term. Carl, do you want to
rhinotelexomania. Mm. And while the majority of the people do use their finger, about 10% use their thumb. And I'm trying it now just on camera. Here we go. Mm. The tip of my little finger easily goes into the nostril. Mate, the thumb doesn't go.
The thumb doesn't go.
But why do 10% of people use their thumb? And 0.5% of people will get a paper clip and then unfold it.
Oh!
Exactly.
No!
Mate, why?
Absolutely
why?
Not. So okay. What was that term again?
Rhino, R-H-I-N-O, telexo, exo meaning out, mania.
Okay, so Simon in Gladstone Park, you're bringing us another term. What is it?
Dermatillomania.
What is that?
So people who compulsively pick at like their face or their fingers, or, you know, people that chew off their cuticles or that sort of thing, a manic picking of the skin.
Ooh.
Oh, so somebody in my family would chew at their fingernails and I'm guessing it's a male person, we fixed him by painting it with nail polish.
Yeah.
And said he can't take it off. And that worked and it didn't get further. So do you know somebody who has this, or is it in your group of friends, or
I've seen a little bit of chatter about it online. I know that there is there's a few products made to try and help people with dermatillomania. You might have heard of picky pads, where they're like little silicon pads with like little beads in them that you can pick out, or you know, there are like little silicon fake noses with fake pimples in them that you can pick, that sort of thing, that are supposed to help people like this.
Although instead of picking your own nose,
I wonder if it actually sort of encourages this behaviour to a degree. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So I'm working on the what works and doesn't have too many side effects. And so if you can have a fake nose in your pocket and then made of silicone rubber or something, and then you pick away at that, I guess that's better than doing your nose. It is a real problem in the sense that it's a condition recognized in psychiatry under DSM-5. DSM is this big fat book, and it stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it shows our lack of advancement in psychiatry, where people are still trying to do the best they can, where to diagnose it, you got these column of symptoms, and if they've got two from column A and one from column B, then they've got disease number XYZ, something like that-ish. So the definition is that it's a body-focused, so it's to do with your body, repetitive, you're doing it over and over again, behavior, and you can have it happening in the nose. You cause some sort of excoriation or damage to the tissues by the recurrent picking. It can be due just to anxiety or boredom and then become a sustained habit, or it could be that you think you don't look good enough and so you'll do it in a degree to a desire to attain some degree of perfectionism. Mm. Or to relieve tension. It has to exclude the situation where it's a physical thing, like, yes, you're in an area where there's a whole lot of little mites and you just got to pick them off, or it's a cultural thing where you will attain enlightenment by slapping yourself gently in the face or scratching your skin, you know, like the whirling dervishes. By whirling around, they actually do achieve a psychedelic state where they're in a state like taking hallucinogenic drugs. And okay, doing a detour here. Often after a disaster, if you get a broad shot of an earthquake, you'll see always there's a few people who are just rocking backwards and forwards, and that actually puts them into a psychedelic state which relieves the badness of where they happen to have been, where their relatives got killed or something like that.
Wow.
Getting back to this condition, you can do things about it. The old standby of cognitive behaviour therapy, which is basically just, you know, getting yourself conditioned out of it. And there's a whole lot of other things you can do. So if anybody's suffering from it, see your GP. Is that kind of help there a bit?
Yeah, Simon, yeah. Thanks for bringing this
helps
forward.
A bit.
Yeah, thank you.
I wonder if elements of it might come from compulsive behaviour as well. You know, you've got to keep the kitchen sink clean, also got to keep your face and your nose clean. And I have a theory, actually, maybe some of this is a little bit of a throwback to our ape ancestors, you know, picking the mites off each other's backs, that sort of thing.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but that sounds perfectly reasonable. Mm. Wow. Look, thank you for starting us on this
Someone's saying, I'm totally not compulsively picking at my finger as this is being said. I'm the same. I'm picking at the cuticles on the side of my nails. Simon, you've brought us a...
Yeah, and be nice to your cuticles and go for nail polish. And if you're embarrassed by wearing nail polish, you can get a clear one.
Cass in Eora, Sydney. Cass, you got a question about body temperature.
Good morning, doctors. I do. I'm wanting to know why do we feel hot when it's 30 degrees, even though that's our natural body temperature?
Ah, because you've got to get rid of your heat. You are continually producing heat at a rate of a tenth of a kilowatt or 100 watts, and you've got to get rid of it, and it only flows downhill. Okay, there was an article about a quantum thing where they could make temperature go uphill. It hurts my head. Quantum still hurts my head. But in general, temperature will only go, or sorry, heat energy will only go from a hot place to a cold place. And if it's 30 degrees on your skin and the outside air temperature is 30 degrees, the heat's not going to flow. You're going to start overheating. You get to 31, and we're just picking these numbers, and then there's a bit of a gradient, and then heat will flow down that temperature gradient. So it's because you've got to apply, for example, sweating, and if you're in that situation where you've got to sweat to lose heat by evaporation, that makes you uncomfortable. So it's because you've got to have a gradient for the heat energy to go down.
Right. Okay. What's our perfect temperature then?
Traditionally, from the past, it's always been 68 Fahrenheit or 20 degrees C, but then that varies enormously depending on what time of day it is, and also whether you're older or younger. If you're carrying a lot of muscle mass, you'll be generating a lot of heat, and so you'll be happier in a colder temperature of, say, 19, and 20 might be just too much for you. But then this can also... I was just reading this other article just this morning about in different parts of the menstrual cycle, your temperature that you deem as comfortable varies. So there's a lot to it. But basically, you're just trying to get rid of heat because you're always generating heat.
Great.
Okay. And 30 is too close to what your body's skin temperature is.
Thanks, Cass. We've got Ryan in Budgerwoy here, or Budgerwoy. Ryan?
Hey,
what's your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could go anywhere in space, anywhere like that you possibly could, where would you go?
Whoa.
And why?
Well, I'd like to go into orbit. That would be amazing. what about you, Lucy? What are you thinking of where you'd like to go?
I would like to go visit the sun.
How close? Like inside?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I'd love to go inside.
That would be incredible.
Yeah, because the inside of the sun is where the heat is generated, and the temperature there is 15 million degrees, and the density is about 150 times that of water. In fact, it's so dense that when a photon is generated, it takes up to 100,000 years to get to the surface because it's absorbed and re-emitted. It'd be wonderful just to be able to look at it. And, of course, I'd love to go on Mars and look closely at some of these things that the Perseverance nuclear-powered six-wheel drive rover is looking at. And if I had the eye of a biologist or a geologist, I could say, wow, that's a sign that there was life here some millions of years ago. Everywhere. Betelgeuse, because Betelgeuse, the giant star, looks like it might do some popping in the future. Oh, WR104, a wolf ray at star 104, which is definitely going to pop any time in the next 7,000 years. And if the beam that it puts out when it pops is aimed at Earth, we're going to lose ozone on half the side of the planet.
Oh, my God.
The chances are very small. Very small, but we'll be probably okay. What about you, Ryan? Yeah. What are you thinking of as your favourite place you want to go to? Oh, black hole, of course. I want to get inside a black hole. Okay, your turn.
Yeah, that would be incredible. Jupiter in the red spot.
That's a good one.
Around there.
The red spot that is four times larger than the Earth. Oh, my God. And it's a storm that's been running for four centuries. We've been watching it all that time.
I think I'd want to go to Saturn and then just travel through the rings.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing. And also I'd like to go to Enceladus, which is a moon going around Saturn, and it's covered with ice. And at the South Pole, there are four big scratches in the ice that they call tiger claws, and coming out of them is water at the rate of 200 kilograms a second, and in the water are the chemicals of life. And I'd like to be able to go through that hole in the ice down to the bottom of the ocean and see life there. Enceladus is probably one of the top contenders for life, not on Earth, somewhere else in the solar system. I'd love to see that.
Oh, incredible. Yeah, it'd just be... Because imagine, you know, going out, saying mountains here, how breathtaking would they be on Mars?
Honestly.
Oh, Mars has the tallest mountain on Earth, in the solar system, 30 kilometres high.
Ryan, you set us off.
Yeah.
Rosie in Melbourne, what do you want to know?
Hi, guys. I just want to know... if the population increasing in the world at the moment is affecting the weight of the world and like the world, the Earth's position in the atmosphere, like the universe. We're talking about how the population is increasing like a lot at universities the other day, and it just got me thinking. So,
okay, so with regard to the Earth orbiting the sun, if you do the equations, the mass of the Earth doesn't matter. So the Earth can be twice as heavy or half the weight. It would still follow the same orbit at the same speed. Secondly, overall, nothing changes in the mass of the Earth. So the atoms are just being rearranged, and they get the energy to do this from the sun, which dumps roughly 1 kilowatt of power continuously onto a square metre of land when the sun is directly overhead. As you head away from the equator, it gets less. And so that 1 kilowatt of power from the sun, it powers everything that we have here. The weather, the tides, plants growing, human life, meat, everything, it powers that. So the atoms just get rearranged. So you eat a tomato, you breathe out some carbon dioxide atoms, they go into a corn plant growing somewhere else, you eat that corn, it then turns into a baby that you may have further down the line. So the mass doesn't change. And then thirdly, the mass does change. And for the life of me, I've forgotten which way up or down it goes, but the numbers are 90,000 and 50,000. And we're losing one of those in terms of hydrogen and helium atoms per year, 50,000 or 90,000. And we're gaining either 50,000 tons of atoms from meteors. So the Earth's mass is increasing or decreasing, I've just forgotten which temporarily, by about 40,000 tons a year-ish. And in the scale of the total weight of the Earth, it really doesn't matter. Does that kind of help?
Cool.
Yeah, but it does go round and round. Yeah. And we're driven by the sun.
Okay, lovely.
Thank you, Dr. Rosie.
Thanks, Rosie. Great question. And Emily in Ngunnawal country. Emily, what do you want to know?
How does gravity pull matter together in space to form a star?
Wow, big question.
Okay, so think about a trampoline, and the trampoline is dead flat. And then I get a little golf ball, and I go flick, and it goes in a straight line. And then if I happen to get a heavy bowling ball and put it in the middle of the trampoline, it curves. And now when I flick my little golf ball, it'll go on a curved path, slightly curved, a lot curved, or even fall into the dip where the bowling ball is. And that's gravity. Gravity is space being curved. So when a whole lot of matter comes together, you then curve the space more and more around it, and stuff travels in straight lines compared to the fabric of the universe, but the fabric is curved. And so with regard to a star, once you get enough hydrogen atoms together to be equal to 70 times the weight of Jupiter, at the middle the pressure is enormous and the temperature is about 15 million degrees C, and then it will ignite. So gravity sucks. And gravity curves is just curved space. Does that kind of help, Emily?
Yeah.
Yes. So chase this up. Look up. Here's a sentence I'll give to you. Play it back later. Space. Sorry. Here comes a sentence. Mass tells space how to curve, comma, and that curved space tells mass where to go. Run it through with your parents, chase it up online. I'm very happy. Ring me at the University of Sydney and I'll be able to help you with it further.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Dr. Emily.
Oh, my God, so sweet. Thank you. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you next week.
Peachy keen. Catch you then.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. And remember to submit your question via our new link below. Can't wait to see what you come up with. My name is Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. And we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.